Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, as usual. And Jim, we start with the good, and we actually start with a healthy group of Senate Democrats who are willing to go against the president when it comes to his insistence that he doesn't really need Congress to approve any deal with Iran. The Senate Democrats pretty much hated the Cotton letter, but Jim, it appears more and more as we get closer to a possible deal here that more Democrats are insisting that there is a role for Congress to play here. You've got folks like Bennett of Colorado, Heitkamp of North Dakota, Nelson of Florida, and here's Tim Kaine of Virginia saying that even though he thinks the Cotton letter was a bad idea, Congress has to have input here.
Let's be realistic here. The deal that is being negotiated with Iran is about what will Iran do in order to get out from under congressional sanctions. And so it is unrealistic to think that Congress is not going to be involved in looking at a final deal.
Kaine was appearing on Meet the Press with Chuck Todd. So, Jim, it says in the Politico version of this story that there are nearly a dozen Democrats who are ready to buck the administration, which by my math still puts it under two-thirds of the Senate. So if they do pass something, it's possible the president could still veto it. But with close to 12 Democrats on board, it's hard for him to win the PR fight here, I would think.
We have, what, 54 Republicans?
Yes.
So that puts you up to 64 senators. That's quite a bit. And that would be a major PR slap to the face. And you also got to wonder, you know, they say a dozen. Look, if this deal is as bad as a lot of people fear, and we may have finally reached a point where there is a certain number of Democrats just aren't willing to take the Obama administration's assurances on faith. The stakes are just too high. It requires coming along and reaching a peaceful, a recognition of the mullahs as the rightful rulers of Iran and trusting them with nuclear ambitions 10 years from now, at least if that's what we're hearing about this report, is this deal is accurate. I think what this kind of says is that all of the brouhaha, all of the weeping and wailing you heard about this Tom Cotton letter really turned out to be kind of a non-entity in terms of shaking Democratic, perspective on this. And even if they thought it was wrong-headed or would have been better done as an op-ed or seemed as some sort of Congress overstepping its bounds, at the end of the day, Democrats in the Senate, a healthy chunk of them are just not feeling good about this, not feeling any sense of reassurance that the Iranians are going to keep their word. I think somebody had summarized the deal very, very simply. They said the deal is a bet that Iran is not really Iran, that they are not what we have come to expect from them from decades and decades going all the way back to 1979. And the other thing is that it bets that 10 years from now, Iran will be even less like it is now, that somehow they will be more willing to play by the rules of international expectations and standards, that they will be open about inspections, that they will be not sponsors of terrorism, etc. Basically, the idea that everything we know about Iran will somehow be overtaken by, they'll just change naturally. What's really driving people crazy about this deal is that there's nothing in the deal that says they're going to change their behavior, that they're going to be a different regime. There's nothing to pressure them to behave more in comportment with international norms. And so for obvious reasons, people have lots of anxiety about this. And it's a suspicion that this administration has just gone out on a limb too far for even the most loyal Democrats, the Tim Kaines of the world.
All right, on to the bad martini now, and more on the Clinton Foundation and its donations. Jim, this is from CBS News. A CBS News investigation has found that at least one foreign company with close ties to its government has been giving generously to the foundation run by Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton. One donor, I think it's pronounced Ryland Enterprises, pledged $2 million in 2013 to the Clinton Foundation's endowment. The company is a privately held Chinese construction and trade conglomerate and run by billionaire Wang Wenliang, who is also a delegate to the Chinese parliament. Public records show the firm has spent $1.4 million since 2012 lobbying Congress and the State Department. So, Jim, in 2013, it's possible she was out of office by the time this happened, but the fact that they were already lobbying when she was in office and the questions about what people and donors can expect if she's elected are going to keep percolating with stories like this.
Greg, are you sure that's not a rerun from the mid-90s? Hit the side of the computer. It seems kind of weird there. We have seen about the actual contributions from foreign governments to the Clinton Foundation. So the Clinton Foundation, they're going to say, oh, it all goes to charity. But let's face it, if you want to if you want to help Haitian earthquake victims, you can give money directly to the Haitian government or Red Cross or various other charities. There's a reason these people give to the Clinton Foundation. By doing it, you're getting an in with the Clintons. If you write a large enough check, they will be very grateful. They will send you a little thank you note. You will probably have a chance to meet them and say, oh, by the way, let me tell you about this really important issue to us. And thus, using a theoretically third party, a private sector factor, which in the case of China, where the private sector begins and where the public sector ends is a very blurry line, the likelihood this is effectively a backdoor way for the Chinese to buy even better relations with the Clintons than they have, because I guess maybe the donations back from the mid-90s may have expired. I don't know.
Jim, on to the crazy martini now, and it just hit me that this is pretty much an all-foreign policy edition of the Three Martini Lunch, but this one is truly crazy. Vladimir Putin did not appear in public for, what was it, 5-6 consecutive days, canceled a couple of public appearances, and the blogosphere and even some fairly trusted news sites decided, well, some people think he's dead. Some people think he has a cold. Some people think there was a coup. Some people think there was an attempted coup that failed. And so they just ran with it because there were a couple people in Russia who thought that might be what happened. Turns out he's apparently fine, and all of this speculation was nonsense, but still kind of crazy about some of the cloak and dagger things going on at the Kremlin, and perhaps even crazier about all the ink that was spilled on something that had pretty much no factual basis.
Well, this is today's crazy vodka martini, Greg. So I'm going to take a moment to kind of defend the speculators. I put up a short item in the corner of the weekend. Look, any foreign, first of all, almost everything about Russia these days is confusing and strange and vaguely menacing. I think they like it this way. Nobody really knows who's really advising Putin or whether he's, his mental state seems a little bit strange. They take a lot of, vaguely threatening actions. No indication that they want to pull back from Ukraine or Crimea. And so when a guy like Putin doesn't appear in public for 8 or 9 days, I think that is a news story. I think that is something kind of unusual. There was a good analysis. I'm going to say her name is Julia Ioff or somebody who used to write for the cover Russia for The New Yorker, now writes for The Washington Post and a couple other places. And she pointed out that it could just have been an ordinary circumstance of, well, he's got the flu and he's bedridden for a couple of days. Except his whole image is the idea of, he's the bare-chested guy wrestling bears and riding horses and this, unbelievably, he looks at women and they get pregnant. That's how virile Vladimir Putin is and stuff. So if you say, yeah, he's got a flu really bad and he's in bed for a week, that creates this impression of weakness. And the Russians dare not show any weakness. So the suggestion there is that they've become this this state where when a routine problem like this comes along, people don't have the option of, or the Russians don't have the option of just saying what's going on and saying, hey, he'll be back at work in a couple of days, he's being informed and everything's fine. People automatically jump to the worst case scenario or the, sinister interpretations of things. So I'm not so sure the media vastly overhyped it. It could just be ordinary sickness, or it could be that there's something going on back there. There are rumors that the assassination of the opposition leader in the street a couple of weeks ago shook up even the Putin supporters, and that some of his inner circle thought that was a little too blatant, a little too direct. We will see if that actually shakes out as the how it actually went, or whether he was just, canoodling with the gymnast girlfriend, or there's some other explanation going on there.
Whoever knows. Jim, enjoy the vodka. Talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in on Tuesday for the next Three Martini Lunch.